For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website. Good morning. Hello to everyone. Welcome to our newcomer. I'm Aishan, Nancy Easton, and I am going to be talking about the Bodhisattva Maitreya today. We've been studying the six major bodhisattvas for our practice commitment period, of which I think we're in the, seventh or eighth week. And I know that Taigen has already spoken quite a lot about specifics about Maitreya's history and qualities and manifestations. And I'm going to just, summarize a little bit of that. And then I want to talk about some other things relating to Maitreya. So as you may remember, Maitreya is a disciple of Shakyamuni Buddha who has been predicted to be the next incarnated Buddha in the distant future. We remember Maitreya in our meal chant when we chant Maitreya Buddha next to be born. And Maitreya really represents the future, our hopes and our dreams for it and our responsibility to future generations. So historically, Maitreya was the first bodhisattva to be described in early sutras and may have been actually based on a historical disciple of Shakyamuni Buddha. His name in Pali is Metta, which is the same kind of root word as the Metta Sutta, the Loving Kindness Sutra. In Chinese, he's known as Milo, and in Japanese, Miroku. And the loving-kindness aspect really describes one of the main qualities of Maitreya, which is his caring and generous nature. So, Maitreya, I think, for me, represents, the spirit of generosity. And there are many historical accounts of Maitreya in which he's sort of depicted as a novice or inexperienced disciple, not particularly distinguished for his wisdom or his rigorous practice, maybe even a little bit foolish. And I think there's something really hopeful in that description of Maitreya, because that description of Maitreya sounds a lot like how I feel at times, and maybe it's how you all feel at times. Feeling like the concept of the idea of enlightenment feels so far away, but even in that foolish, naive, kind of not distinguished state, Maitreya has been predicted to be, awakened as Buddha in the future, and so it speaks to the promise of practice, and which for Maitreya involves primarily waiting in Tushita heaven to be reborn as Buddha, just for some very uncertain time frame. It's quite unclear when exactly Maitreya will be born as the future Buddha. Some accounts estimate about 7.5 billion years, which, even under the most hopeful conditions, I think we could imagine that we might even actually evolve into some other species. Some accounts suggest 30,000 years. Some are very specific and say the year 4,456, Common Era. I don't know enough to know what that specifically refers to. So it's not really clear how long Maitreya will be waiting in Tushita heaven. It's also very unclear what the conditions are under which Maitreya will appear. There is one view which I think is popular in many Asian cultures, which is that the world is devolving, that That the idea that contemporary people of whatever time, you know, can't match the wisdom of the past sages. When we think of, and we often think of this, you know, popularly as our world in the West as well. And the idea is that things are going to continue to devolve, and practice will decline, and the teachings will be, you know, forgotten or not practiced. And then Maitreya will return in the culmination of this evil age to bring some clarity and awakening and compassion and enlightenment to us, whoever we are at that point, which tends to kind of lend Maitreya sort of a messianic quality as sort of a hope for a better life in the future. There's one saying that, you know, Maitreya will appear when the world is ready for him, whenever that is. There is sort of almost also the complete opposite account, which is that, which indicates that Maitreya will come when the world is already become pure and wholesome. And in Faces of Compassion, Tagen talks about the White Lotus Movement, which arose around 5th century China, but I think was still active into, you know, sort of the early part of the 19th century, whose practitioners advocated social justice and reform, ethical conduct of communities, and devotional practices to help Maitreya reappear in the world. And these groups sort of would engage in beneficial activities to help the poor and oppressed, but they were sort of opposed to and outside of the establishment and were outlawed because they threatened to the contemporary political powers, which they viewed as corrupt and degenerate, and so they sort of saw themselves as, you know, it's our responsibility to transform the world into something that will work for Maitreya. So, into a world in which Maitreya can manifest. So, I think this speaks to we can think of two ways of thinking about the world or working in the world. One is other power, that we rely on another power outside of ourselves, and that's maybe the wish that Maitreya come and you know, help the world. And then there's self power, which is, you know, it's my responsibility to clean things up, and I'm going to help manifest Maitreya. And I think that's a constant tension that's present in thinking about any of the bodhisattvas. I want to also touch on the paramitas that are associated with Maitreya. Paramitas are the transcendent practices or qualities that characterize bodhisattvas, such as giving or ethical conduct or effort or vow or meditation or wisdom. And there are three in particular that are associated with Maitreya. The first being generosity. That, you know, Maitreya's character is based on devotion and loving kindness, more active than Kanon's hearing the cries of the world and responding. Maitreya really represents sort of love and generosity actively going out into the world. If you are familiar with the 10 ox herding pictures, you may remember that the final picture depicts a practitioner who has sort of, they're all about, you know, sort of different stages of practice, and the final picture depicts a practitioner who's fully integrated their spiritual practice with caring for the world and is returning to the marketplace with empty, bliss-bestowing hands. That's sort of the culmination. And the picture, actually, in a couple of versions that I've seen, is of the monk Hote, who is thought to be sort of a historical incarnation of Maitreya, who's if you're familiar with sort of the jolly, fat, laughing Buddha who carries a big sack over his shoulder. His name actually means cloth bag, and he was known for carrying a sack filled with candy and toys for children, and has a very playful nature, which is I think part of what another part of why he's associated with Maitreya, is this, you know, kind of young, youthful, naive, maybe foolish practitioner who is just filled with generosity and goodness. And so Maitreya is just someone who's actively giving before things are needed, which sort of distinguishes him from Avalokiteshvara or Kannon, who is responding to the needs. This is just, you know, the spirit of giving, sort of without forethought. Another quality, another paramita that is associated with Maitreya is the paramita of patience, which you can, I think, readily recognize. You know, Maitreya is waiting for Buddhahood to happen, you know, at an indeterminate time in the distant future. And that takes some patience. You know, I think for all of us, we need to find a way to find some peace and balance in the midst of uncertainty while we are trying to understand, you know, what is the best action or response to a given situation. Sometimes action itself can be, you know, unskillful or inadvisable in a given situation, but we can, you know, patiently wait for the situation to become a little bit more clear or for our understanding of it to ripen before we act. And that process comes about partly as the result of patience, but also maybe because of another paramita that's associated with Maitreya, which is meditation, which for practiced as Maitreya is more sort of a concentration on the study of self, you know, examining consciousness to discover causes and conditions for both suffering and awakening. Maitreya is very patiently contemplating the rising and falling of physical and mental phenomena and their mutual interactions. And through this kind of practice, we can gain some clarity and self-knowledge so that we can increase our ability to act kindly and skillfully in situations. I know we have talked before about Maitreya being associated with the Yogacara school of Buddhism, and Yogacara is sort of consciousness only, and meaning that the focus of the Yogacara school is trying to understand human consciousness and how our six sense organs, or six consciousnesses, sight, hearing, smell, taste, touch, and the functions of our mind, which is considered another form of consciousness. We focus on how the six of these elements interact with our kind of storehouse of experiences, which are called the storehouse consciousness, to condition our perception of reality, or what we call reality, which is really something that we are constantly you know, perceiving, but then co-creating. We're not perceiving reality objectively. Maitreya is allegedly responsible for transmitting these teachings to a Sangha who was with Vasubandhu, one of the developers of the Yogacara school. And so when you think about it, meditation, as well as psychotherapy, I would say, as a psychotherapist, can really help us to take a closer look at how we ourselves are creating our experience of what's happening and can see our blind spots. It's often true that we all have blind spots, actually, and sometimes in listening to someone describe a problem that they're having with the situation, sometimes you can see that the problem, the solution is right there in the midst of the problem, but the person is sort of skipping over that piece. And sometimes just talking with someone or studying your own experience in meditation can help you sort of pause enough to see, oh, okay, yeah, I missed that part. that where I might have an opportunity to intervene. So Maitreya is, you know, practicing. I mean, it epitomizes generosity, is practicing patience, is practicing studying all of the causes and conditions that are arising within him and around him that are contributing to situations, and waiting and thinking about how to act. And I think I think it's important to recognize that Maitreya is not just waiting to become Buddha, because that very common characterization of Maitreya is, I think, where problems arise in thinking about Maitreya. If we think about, you know, Maitreya is just, you know, waiting in Tushita heaven to become the Buddha in the future, to be reborn as Buddha in the future, there's a little problem with that. Does anybody kind of have a thought about what the problem with that is? Yeah, well, that's one. When is the future? Well, it's in the future. Or I guess you could say it starts immediately. There's something that's important about distinguishing, you know, what is the future? Is the future something out there, or is it a manifestation of our present actions, or, you know, what exactly is it? And I know we were talking about Vimalakirti a couple weeks ago, and we talked about the Vimalakirti Sutra, in which the premise is that Vimalakirti, who is a esteemed and enlightened layperson, is ill, and Shakyamuni Buddha assembles the bodhisattvas and wants them to go visit Vimalakirti on his sickbed, and they all sort of politely decline for various reasons. And Maitreya's reason is, and the gist of the reasons are that Vimalakirti has sort of poked holes in, you know, sort of the premise of and practices of each of the bodhisattvas. And so for Maitreya, he expresses reluctance to visit Vimalakirti on his sickbed because Vimalakirti has criticized this very status as a future Buddha by pointing out that the past and the present and the future are really illusions. They all exist right now, or they don't exist at all. The future is the future of the present, and the present is the present. The past is just the future, you know? You can't get out of it. In addition, he also points out that there is no personal attainment of Buddhahood, that when a Buddha awakens, all beings awaken with that Buddha and they attain liberation together. So attaining Buddhahood in the future is really a delusion, and Maitreya is brought to silence by this argument. And I think that this has a particular relevance for us today, that in a couple of different ways. We can fall into a trap of, you know, waiting for this perfect wisdom that a Buddha of the future represents. You know, can we fall into a trap of waiting for this before taking action, or similarly, maybe wanting a perfect response from others and turning away from them when we don't receive it, and saying, you know, nope, I'm going to wait for Maitreya. And people sometimes historically have, you know, prayed for Maitreya to come and help the world, or have prayed to be reborn so that they can, you know, be in Tushita heaven with Maitreya. And I think that this is a mistake, because it does, as Caroline, I think you were kind of pointing to it, it pulls us out of the present and our responsibility to act in the present, to take care of the future. You know, Maitreya exists in infinite time and space, but we actually don't. You know, we're finite beings in a limited world, and even if he were to, you know, be reborn as early as the year 4456, none of us will be there, at least in our present incarnation. And, you know, I think it's maybe a little bit of a falling into over-reliance on this other power to help the world and neglecting a little bit of self-power. So it brings up a question of, you know, how can we work with the world as it is? And I think one of the things that Vimalakirti points to is really the myth of individual action, you know, that all beings awaken with a Buddha. And this is true in a very mundane way in our lives as well right now. You know, we really need others and other perspectives and voices to add to our own understanding of the world. No one can become, you know, awakened in a vacuum. You know, we really need others to help us refine and produce a better response to the conditions of our world. We need to, you know, act together to help situations. And we have a lot of situations, especially, you know, it seems like in our country over the past couple of years, things have become increasingly polarized and divided, and we have a tendency to want to, you know, shut out or silence voices that differ from our own. I know that today we are kind of, again, you know, recovering from the aftermath of another school shooting, this time in Texas, where I think 10 students have died and one law enforcement officer. And I think that thinking about Maitreya right now is, you know, extremely poignant in his love for children and caring for children and the way that children represent our future. And it's especially poignant to think about, you know, the ways in which our children and our future are in so much pain that they are, you know, shooting other children or resorting to violence. And I don't know, I do not know the solution to this. But I was reading a little bit and saw that the chief of the Houston Police Department spoke out, you know, sort of shared his views about the hatred being spewed, as he put it, by many people in our country towards other people who share opposing views, and sort of used this as one source of blame along with he's really against the prevalence of guns as a source of blame for our current, you know, increasing resorting to violence to resolve situations. You know, and I really think that it is important to practice for all of us with our wish to turn away from or to silence others who take different views from us. I know we all can face this. Many of us, I have friends who are, you know, really into guns, and that's hard. That's a challenge for me, and I know that many of us have family members who feel very differently from ourselves, and it's hard to figure out, you know, how do we practice with that? We want kindness from others, but we sometimes have a hard time feeling that others deserve kindness from us, particularly when we feel that they are doing something wrong or that their views are wrong. And yet I think it's also true, as Thich Nhat Hanh said, that, you know, the only way to peace is through peace. And so, you know, how can we maybe practice with some of these qualities of Maitreya and bring them to our world. You know, how can we practice, for instance, letting go a little bit of our whatever it is we're holding on to, whether it's a particular view or a feeling or a, you know, something in a situation, and bring some kindness to some of the conflict that we're facing, and that you know, and I think in a very real way, we grow up with, you know, and we become kind of used to it, and I think that that's maybe part of what happens with our children, and that you know, the teenagers in Parkland, Florida, I think in particular, are trying to speak out against, like, we're not just gonna, you know, sort of be used to this anymore. We need to speak out about this. So I really just want to sort of mention one particular practice, and then maybe there's a time for us to have a little bit of discussion. People are maybe familiar with metta practice or loving kindness practice, and metta, as I mentioned before, is a sort of the same root word as metta or maitreya. And is everybody familiar with what loving kindness practice? Anybody not familiar? I'll mention it anyway. So the idea is that we, you know, we find a way to sort of calm ourselves down and generate some energy in your heart center, bring your focus to your heart center, and we start to begin to generate, you know, kind and compassionate feelings towards ourselves, starting with yourself, because we can't bring kindness to others until we really can feel it in ourselves and towards ourselves. So the idea with metta practice is that you let go of, you know, your own self-judgment or your feelings of unworthiness, and you think specific things like, you know, may I be happy, may I be safe, may I be free from suffering, may I be filled with joy and ease. And you practice with that for a period of time, however long seems appropriate to you. And then what you do is you move on to someone that you readily feel these feelings towards, someone that you love, that you can feel, you know, very readily, may that person be happy, safe, free from suffering, filled with joy and ease. And when you've practiced with that person for a while and really generated, you know, some strength in these feelings, then you extend that to a neutral person, someone who inspires in you neither, you know, love nor dislike. Practice with that person for a while, and then, you know, then finally you practice with someone, thinking about someone with whom you really have some difficulty, whether it's someone you know personally or someone who, you know, a public figure. I'm not going to name any names. but the idea is that as we practice this, it becomes more of our character and more of how we approach the world, and helps us, I think, to approach these very difficult and conflicted situations with some kindness and generosity, and, you know, hopefully maybe even some increased clarity on, you know, the perspective of the other person and what might actually help them to come around to our perspective rather than trying to force that on them. So I think that this aspect of Maitreya or loving kindness is something that we can, you know, really readily bring to our engagement with the world. And so one way that we can, you know, make Maitreya's practice relevant to our lives and maybe also, you know, engage with that spirit of Maitreya or the spirit of generosity and loving kindness for ourselves and others. Oh, I was going to quote Dogen. I was going to quote Dogen earlier because this was occurring to me and I just didn't insert it in the talk anywhere, but you can quote this anywhere. So this is what I want to say relative to Maitreya. Dogen in the Shobo Genzo, there's an essay called The Awesome Practice of Active Buddhas. And in the very famous passage is, know that Buddhas in the Buddha way do not wait for awakening. Active Buddhas alone fully experience the vital process on the path of going beyond Buddha. This is something that self-manifested Buddhas have never dreamed of. So Buddhas in the Buddha way do not wait for awakening. It's okay maybe for the archetype of Maitreya to be engaging in his activity while waiting. But we need to continue to awaken and to go beyond awakening, Buddha going beyond Buddha, as part of our engagement in the world. So I hope that, you know, I hope that that fills you with a little bit of inspiration for, you know, at least to inspire a discussion about, you know, ways that we might engage with Maitreya. So thank you very much. So if anyone has comments or questions or thoughts about Maitreya or anything else, now's the time when we can have a little discussion. Kathy.
Thank you for your talk. It was really interesting. And it makes me think, you know, lately I've been just observing, you know, the whole issue of racial divide in this country is just coming to a head. And I've noticed that, you know, like I have one friend who is calling out all the racist things that are happening, calling everybody a POS, and it's kind of like he's very angry, very, very angry. And finally it's like, okay, this is too much for me, I can't deal with this. And so that's one. There's the calling out that some people might be able to do. And then the other one, you know, was represented in the, I don't know if you listened to On Being, WBC on Sunday mornings, but this morning she was talking about it, and I've heard more shows like this lately, where there was a guy who had been white nationalist, and he talked about how he transitioned away from that. And the way he did it was, there were people in his life, I think of different racial backgrounds, who were very, who became friends with him, and who supported him, and some people who were able to give him things in terms of guidance that he appreciated. And at some point within that friendship, it became clear, maybe somebody said, and he could see it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This, anybody else who wants to care about. But that, I heard another guy who used to be part of the KKK say something similar, that it was through relationships that he finally stood back and realized that what he was practicing didn't even make sense to him. Mm-hmm. So people join sometimes in order to belong.
Mm-hmm. That you with both examples, I find myself wondering, you know, what might be motivating that person? You know, that what is it that your friend, well, you're with your friend and with this person on the radio, you know, what might your friend have experienced that leads them to be in the state that they're in, and to where that feels like the right action, and what might this other person might, you know, have experienced earlier in their life that led them to feel that was, you know, that white supremacy was sort of the way to go, and that they, and clearly they were open to, you know, hearing other views somehow, even maybe without even intending to be open to hear other views. You know, that's sounds like a really beautiful action on the part of the friends, as well as that person.
There's a developmental process that you have
to, yeah,
go through, that things impact us and have the potential to change it.
Yeah, so many things are a developmental process. And I think a lot of times in protests, you know, you hear like, what do we want? whatever, and then when do we want it now? And now is good, but now doesn't always happen either. And sometimes we have to, if it doesn't happen now, we need to maybe look a little bit deeper at what are the causes and conditions that are preventing that from being now? What are the causes and conditions that are actually supporting whatever it is that we have right now that we don't want? Yeah. Somebody posted an article a while back that was maybe from the New York Times about why protests don't work. And I'm not saying that they never work, but when they don't work, it's because, according to this person, the situations are really not amenable to something that can just suddenly be changed with one action. They're profound, you know, they have profound systemic roots, and it takes a long time to dismantle those systemic roots. Kind of like the conditions that led to the fall of the Berlin Wall that we were talking about a couple weeks ago. In that instance, that's a helpful motive on the part of your friend. Russ?
Part of some of my observations, I think protests are very useful in helping increase enthusiasm for people who tend to already be disposed to agree with you. Which can be important. Sometimes it's hard through protests or in our own political environment to make human connections with people who are on the other side of an issue.
Yeah.
And I think between our news and media, political climate, it's just hard to make those connections. And oftentimes people are put in different opposing camps before they, and I'm not even given the opportunity to make those sort of connections.
Yeah.
Can make progress if you do make a connection with somebody over a shared interest or, you know, something you agree with.
Yeah.
And then you realize, wow, this person on this political issue thinks completely differently than I do. And what do I do about that? And maybe, you know, having the opportunity for an open-minded discussion can be a way to make progress.
Yeah. I think you're kind of talking about seeing others as people, you know, rather than as objects to be changed, you know, seeing them as subjects in their own right, and finding a way to connect over something that you can agree on. Without overemphasizing the focus on your, you know, your end goal. But really just talking. I agree. Yeah.
Sure. I have read about it and dabbled with it. But mostly it seems to come up a lot in the Theravada traditions.
Uh-huh.
And I haven't heard it spoken of a lot in the Zen traditions. And sometimes you read things about Zazen that kind of suggests that metta practice wouldn't be a part of that. So
So what do I say about that?
I'm curious about, like, how, as a Zen practitioner, what might be some good ways to think about incorporating a metta practice?
I don't know if I have an agenda for anybody's practice. But I think that we all can incorporate things when, you know, whenever we want to. You could sit down, you know, at home and devote some time in meditation to really just doing that, just doing a metta practice. I don't myself do it very often. I think I worked with it for a while, and I just haven't for some reason. But it's always available as something for something if you want to cultivate. I don't know that there's a specific canon. I think you're right that it's not part of what we typically do in Zazen, but it's certainly something that one could do.
In Northwest Indiana, I was a member of a Korean Sangha. And we recited the Metta Sutra every night, every Tuesday. And so he would encourage us just to make copies of it on the internet. And there were people who literally meditated off and on every day, and they would read it. They would read it out loud to us. That's one option.
That's a good one too. We often chant the Metta Sutta during service, like on Monday nights. We don't do it on Sundays, but it's definitely a part of our sangha as well. And finding a way to, you know, kind of connect with that spirit of loving kindness. But thank you. Did that answer? Okay. Yeah. Phyllis.
Often, I was exposed to it, and what I want to add to all that is that at the beginning, I also felt like it doesn't quite jive with this sitting still practice, because to me, sitting still in a cushion, large part of it has to do with self-discovery. And this meta practice seems like it's not quite the same. And so I was really pushed to do it because I was in a meta meditation retreat. That's the method you're supposed to use for that day. And I realized that it can also be a self-discovery journey. That's what you're inclined to do. What I discovered was it's actually extremely difficult for me to send loving kindness thought to myself. It's much easier. The second step is much easier. The third one is also easy. The fourth one is understandably difficult. But I was very surprised that I can't do the first one. So that's just me. So you might find that it helped in examining yourself as well, although it has the added benefit to help regenerate that kindness thought for others.
Yeah. Thank you. You know, you're also kind of pointing to the ways in which the self is not separate from others. The things that we have difficulty with in others are also often the things we have difficulty with in ourselves, and that's something to, you know, observe when we are focused on you know, why this person does this or this, you know, this, even just things like, you know, the roots of violence are often in our own, very, very present in our own thinking and our own ways of interacting in the world, even though we may have we may have lives that make it a lot easier to refrain from acting in violence, but we often have some of the same thoughts that lead to violence, such as, you know, really vehemently insisting that something be a way other than it is, and that we're going to make it that way. You know, that's kind of maybe step one or step 0.5 on the scale to, you know, erupting in violence. So you're right. That's a good reminder that noticing, you know, aspects of ourselves that we find difficult can really teach us a lot about how we might then also you know, engage kindly with someone else that we find difficult. So, I know we're getting close to the end, but I want to just see if there's one last question. David?
It's a question that, I really haven't been exposed to meta practice, but I find it hearing people say, well, it's different than what we do in Zen. I'm questioning because I'm going right back to Rev Anderson's thought of dependent co-arising. And what you say, the self is not separate from others. So isn't that, how is that in conflict with metta?
I didn't mean to imply that it was in conflict. I just meant that we don't typically actively, focus on metta during zazen. We don't typically focus on the practice of, bringing loving kindness to ourselves, extending it to different people, the sort of the concrete nature of it. I think the spirit of it is very much present.
Yeah, it seems so contradictory to dependent co-arising.
Yeah, to say that.
This is somewhere, often.
Yeah.
In the wings and not important.
No, hopefully metta is increasingly close at hand. the quality, but the practice we don't typically do. But it is certainly something that, maybe we could practice with. Maybe we could, whatever practice, helps us to relate kindly to ourselves and others, I think is a good thing.
One last comment. Yeah. I found a way here listening to Reverend Curry talk about his speech at the wedding yesterday and talking about it and saying that we're all children of God and in essence we should treat each other as brothers and sisters and to have that kind of kindness. And I think that's so, from my perspective, it's something very much like Zen in a way, because we're saying we're not separate.
Yeah.
We are all related. And I think that's where we miss the gap. We think that the other person is separate from us, and therefore we get to impose our will, or they're imposing their will on us, mm-hmm. rather than finding commonality.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the lack of commonality and sharing and being with each other as both brothers and sisters, as family, is what leads so much to the violence that we have.
Sure, and practicing with that, I think, is a way to make it real. Engaging with that as a practice is, I think, a way to bring it to life beyond, just words. So thank you. So thanks, everyone. Before...